Hi everybody, my name is Helen Ridgway and I'm a very enthusiastic member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon and Al-Ateen. I've noticed over the weekend that y'all talk a little bit faster than I do. And you also have a very strange accent. I've had a little bit of difficulty understanding some of the words that you use. But maybe you won't have that much trouble understanding me. I was one of those southern girls that before I could say I wasn't that kind of girl, I was. So over the years, I've learned to talk a little bit faster. I want to thank y'all for inviting me to come. As the night wore on and now it's 9 o'clock, I thought maybe some of y'all would get tired and leave, but it looked like just more and more people kept coming in. So there was a lovely basket in my room when I arrived, and it had all of these wonderful goodies in it that I had really enjoyed, and my room is absolutely gorgeous. And I thought, my, I should have invited a lot of the girls that I sponsor to come up here with me. We could have had a really big time in this room, you know. But I've enjoyed it immensely. The workshops have been great. The other speakers have really touched my heart. I'll probably say something about that later, but you know what? It's the AA ones that I keep identifying with, which really is kind of scary. But, you know, last night, one of the AA speaker talked about he'd rather be dead than not look good, and I was that way, and that's what almost killed me. That's really what got me here, because I was almost dead when I came to you. My story begins at birth, actually, because I grew up loving alcoholics. My mother was an alcoholic, and she drank vodka from the time she got up in the morning till she went to bed at night. My father was a very well-respected physician by day, and he was a drunk by night. I had two much older sisters who were 8 and 9 years older than I was, and I have a younger brother who's retarded. So it was a real interesting family. And although I live in Texas now, I grew up in Mississippi, and so we were a fairly well-to-do southern family that kept a lot of secrets. I know people in New England know of something about keeping secrets, and we in the South know about that too. Maybe that is not generic to where we live, but it's what happens in every family. But I was determined that no one was going to know what went on in my home. My sisters left home by the time I was 9 years old, and alcoholism had really, really become rampant in our home. I don't know how it was in this part of the country, but in the South, or at least in Mississippi, alcohol was not legal. And so we had bootleggers. And I don't know if y'all know what a bootlegger is or not, but it's somebody that sells liquor illegally. And I don't mean moonshine. I mean in the bottle with the label on it and everything. Well, he used to come to our house once a week and unload cases of whiskey into our basement. And then he would come back the next week and he would take away the empty bottles and bring back new ones. And I knew that wasn't going on in everybody's house. I was certain of it. But I didn't know what to do about it. So I did all of the things as a young child that we do when we marry alcoholics. I tried so hard to be nice, to be good, to keep my parents from drinking. I hid bottles. I tried to be funny. I tried to be cute. I tried to be quiet. I tried to take care of my brother. Nothing worked. They just kept drinking and drinking. But sometimes one of them would quit drinking for a while, and they would do what they called, they went on the wagon. Well, if they were going on the wagon and you heard them talking about this, you did not want to be at home. It was much better when they were drinking. Much better. Because they never went on the wagon at the same time. So one of them was always angry at the other one if they were on the wagon. You know, you've got the picture. And meanwhile, you know, they were sending me to church every Sunday and Wednesday night. This afternoon, again, the AA talked about being Irish Catholic, and they talked about the help and the peaceful feeling that they felt in church. Well, I definitely am not Irish Catholic. I think you can tell that by the way I talk and the way I grew up. However, we went to the First Baptist Church in Jackson, Mississippi, and you would think that I heard hellfire and damnation in that church, but I never heard that. I felt secure and safe in that place. And probably the reason was because I felt so afraid at home, and I needed a sanctuary and a safe place. And that was a safe place to me. It's funny because in my later years, some friends and I bantered around and talked about what it was like in that church growing up, and they did not see it the way I saw it at all. But they weren't living in the home that I was living in, and they weren't trying so hard to keep the family secret. You know, we have a pamphlet called Understanding Ourselves, and in there it talks about our guilt and our obsession and our fears, and those were all of the things that I felt and had. I had absolutely no social skills. My sisters were beautiful and smart, and I thought I was ugly and dumb. I wore braces on every single tooth in my head until I was a senior in high school. I had really thick glasses, and I sang with a group of women, girls in high school, and there were six of us, and this was in the 60s, and we wore cute little black dresses, little scoop neck things, you know, and I come from sturdy stock. I have very large legs for a little bitty body, and they called me elephant legs. And they called the girl next to me bird legs. Now, she was plump. I was skinny. I mean, I was really little. And but it was just our legs sticking out from these black dresses. So I really knew that I was ugly. And it's those kind of things that I took to heart. And I didn't know what to do with them. And I had nobody that I could talk about them to. I didn't know either how to relate to boys. I knew nothing about relationships and nothing about dating or anything like that. But when I was a senior in high school, somebody got me a date with this guy who was a junior in college there, and he was exciting, let me tell you. He played in a band, and he drank. Now, he didn't drink like my parents, you know. He drank fun stuff, not scotch and not vodka, but, you know, really fun, exciting things. And we would go out to these dances, and he would play the music, and I would get to be, you know, a part of, and it was really exciting. And besides, he paid attention to me. So I thought this was wonderful. Well, he went to college there in Jackson, so I thought, you know, where should I go? What should I do? I would just follow him. I didn't know what I wanted or who I was. So I went there also, and he majored in English, so I thought, well, I better major in English too, because, you know, that made sense to me. I didn't know what else to do. So we got there, and, you know, there was a whole other group of people there than I had gone to high school with, people that didn't know me, and other guys started paying attention to me. And I thought, this is kind of nice, you know. Maybe this is not the only person in the world for me. So he wanted me to get married, and I thought, oh, I don't think so. So he went off and got his master's degree in Iowa. He wanted me to get married and live in a Quonset hut. Can you imagine? I mean, heavens. You know, I come from a very well-to-do family. I'm going to live in a Quonset hut, for heaven's sake. So he went on off, and I went to Ole Miss, which is, I don't know what your party school is up here, but it was like the party school in Mississippi. And as I said, this was in the 60s, and it was a real partying place and lots of fun. And but I forgot that I didn't have any social skills, and I didn't know how to act and what to do. And I was like a fish out of water in this place. I was absolutely miserable. But I went and did the things and looked on the outside because, you know, I'm going to look good. I'm not going to look stupid. I'm going to look good. Now, I don't feel stupid, but I'm going to look good. And I was working real hard at looking good. I got my ears pierced, and that was real racy back then. I mean, real racy. My roommate and I, now I went to the dermatologist to get them pierced. I mean, I certainly didn't go to one of these places where, you know, you either do it yourself or in the mall, heaven forbid. But I got my ears pierced. And so I thought, man, I am on the edge, and I am really moving forward here. Well, there again, I didn't have any social skills. So one night I had a date, and we went to this dance, and the Hot Nuts were playing. I'm sure y'all never heard of them, but they were a great band in the South. And they sing a song, Nuts, Hot Nuts, you get them from the Peanut Man, and they were playing that song, and my dad had given me my very first drink. I'd never had a drink at this point, and it was a gin and 7-Up. And I wanted him to go fix me another one, but they were playing that song, and he didn't want to go. And he had his little bottle in a brown paper sack. And so I just took the gin and turned the bottle up and drank it straight out of that. Well, needless to say, I was a little sick. And I can look out and tell that most of y'all are too young to know this, and maybe in the East they didn't do that, but in the South in the 60s we had house mothers, and you had to sign in. I mean, it was no open door, and I'm telling you, I couldn't walk a straight line if my life depended on it. So they called back to the dorm, and they got somebody to come down and get me and all this kind of stuff, and everybody in the dorm was so shocked because I was Miss Goody Two-Shoes, except for having my ears pierced. And so I got in, but I tell you this story because, number one, that's what alcohol did to me, and I didn't like it. And number two, because I knew I was a failure, I picked up the phone the next morning and called that guy that had gone to graduate school in Iowa and told him that he was right, he was the one for me, and we needed to get married, and he needed to come quick. And he said, okay. Now, you wonder why I have trouble with the first step. He rode the train from Iowa to Batesville, Mississippi, and I picked him up in my little green Nash Rambler, and we went across the line into Alabama, and we got married, and I had on my little white, nice pleated wool skirt, my little white wool sweater. I remember it well. And then we went back to Batesville, and we spent the night in the Batesville Motel, and then the next morning he got on the train, went back to Iowa, and I went back to the dorm. And then the next morning, I woke up out of a blackout. I am certain of it. And I knew that I had made a serious error. I told you I came from a very well-to-do family. I mean, what were they going to think? Now, alcoholism notwithstanding, I would have embarrassed my family. I mean, heavens, I couldn't do this. So I called him up and I said, we have made a terrible mistake. We need to get engaged. I don't know why y'all are laughing. You haven't heard the whole story. So he said, okay. See, I'm still having trouble with the first step. I'm not powerless at all. Well, that August in Jackson, Mississippi, in the First Baptist Church, we got married with 12 bridesmaids, 12 groomsmen, and 2 flower girls. And you think that marriage lasted? Nope. Well, I didn't have to go to Iowa with him. He came and went to graduate school there, and then we went off to the University of Arkansas, and things were not going well with our marriage, and I can't imagine why. And I still had no skills whatsoever. I had learned how to cook a little bit. I neglected to tell you that. I did tell you, I believe, that my mother didn't cook clean or sew. We had a lady that came to work at our house every morning at 7 o'clock in the morning and went to home every night at 8 after she served dinner in the dining room on all the silver and china. Now, I know today that that is not reality, but I did not know it back then, and I was never allowed in the kitchen except to talk to Rosalie, and she never wanted me to learn to cook because she wanted to take care of me. And I learned all of my skills at her knee because I wanted to learn how to take care of people, too. So by the time I moved to the University of Arkansas with Johnny, I thought, well, maybe what will fix this marriage is have a baby, right? So 9 months later, I had a baby, and 9 months after that, we were divorced. And I was back living with my parents because I didn't have any place to go. I didn't have anything to do. I didn't know what to do with myself. I did finish college and got a job, and then moved out on our own, and my son by that time was almost 2. And we were having a fine time. I drove a little bitty Volkswagen, and I was really enjoying myself. And I would pick him up from daycare and take him home and stop by the Crystal and getting some hamburgers. And my husband, the husband I have now, told me later that the reason he married me was because he was afraid Jack was going to get scurvy because I never fed him anything. But he was getting a hot meal in the day at daycare, don't you think? I mean, I was a good mother. I was a good mother. I never left him, never forgot him, didn't do any of those things. But was trying to move on with my life, and I didn't know what that meant. But I knew that I was never going to get married again. Wasn't ever going to do that again. I mean, that was a mistake, I'm telling you. But, you know, I started looking for love in all the wrong places and getting into places that I shouldn't have been and shouldn't have gone and wish I hadn't have gone and wish I hadn't have been. And then I met this really nice older man. I had been out singing with a group of ladies one night, and somebody had invited me over, and there he was. And he was just going through a divorce, and he had a 10 and a 12-year-old, and they needed me. And I could tell it immediately. I mean, it was just like that. Now, he drank a little bit, you know, but I thought, I can fix that. So we decided 6 months later to get married. I didn't believe in short engagements. Never did. And about a week before we got married one night, he and my boss happened to get drunk together. And, you know, I was really upset. And after my boss left that night, I said, you know, Lewis, I really don't do drunk, whatever that means, and I don't want to ever see you drunk again. And he said, I'll never do it again. And I believed him. And you know that for the next 15 years, he was drunk on a daily basis, and I never, ever acknowledged it. And what do you think that does to a person? It absolutely kills their soul. I threw away empty bottles every morning. I never saw them. Never. I was very fortunate. At least he told me this. He only drank at home. He never went to bars. I never had to go look for him. You know, I hear people talking about peering through the blinds and waiting for him to come home. I never had to do that. I knew where he was. He was sitting in his chair, fondling the clicker, drinking his drink. I even made him martinis and brought them to him in the bathtub. Now, I didn't drink, but he taught me how to do all of this. But I pretended he wasn't doing that. I was sharing with somebody earlier about my sleep habits. I'm one of these people that I just turn down the little corner of the bed, slip right in, pull it over me, don't move, go straight to sleep, and wake up the next morning and nothing has moved in the bed. And you know how I got that way? From years of living with active alcoholism, the active alcoholism that I lived with drank in the bed, smoked in the bed, and watched television till 2 or 3 in the morning with all the lights on. And at 10 o'clock every night, he says 9 o'clock. I don't think so. 10 o'clock every night, I would just turn back the little corner of the bed and get right in and go to sleep. I always told him it was my clean conscience. He didn't like that. But anyway, I think, you know, that was one of those things that God gave me, was the ability to sleep through all of that. Because we probably would not have stayed married had it not been for that. Because I would have been irritable and unreasonable without knowing it long before I got there. But don't worry, I did get there. You know, our literature has some of these wonderful lines in it that I think, gosh, were they living in my house or what? I wouldn't have to tell you my story because in How Al-Anon Works, it says, living with alcoholism caused us to suppress or ignore our emotions, our desires, our hopes. We hid our feelings in order to survive, and in time, we forgot we ever had feelings. We succeeded in insulating ourselves so well that we no longer participated enthusiastically in life. In attempting to protect ourselves, we let our personalities slip away until we were emotionally numb. And that was what happened to me. I became one of those people who absolutely did not have anything inside. Lewis had these two children, and they came to live with us, and I had the one, and he adopted him. And I thought if we had ours, that it would make things complete. So we got married in 1970, and in 1974 I had finally twisted his arm enough that we made a contract and decided to try for 1 year to see if we could have a baby. And boy, I tried hard. And at the end of 10 months, I finally found myself pregnant. And we have a little girl, and she's 27 years old today. But it was interesting with that family of his, mine, and ours. There again, I was going to make it look perfect, and I was going to make it look good. Now, we had a few marital problems, just a few. And but we never mentioned alcoholism, never. And we never talked about drinking. We went to a psychologist, we went to therapists, we went to our minister, all of those things, but we never, never mentioned that there was a problem with alcoholism. I would never have done that, never, because that was the sacred secret. I had learned that very early on, and I had learned that lesson well. And by this time, my mother had died, and we had put my father in treatment twice. And I got real involved in institutions work after I got in Al-Anon, and the reason was because at both of those treatment centers that my father went to in the 70s, they never ever mentioned to us that it was a family disease and that there was a place for us called Al-Anon. And I don't know why that never happened, but it didn't. And after I got in Al-Anon, I wanted to be one of those people that carried the message to those people in those institutions and in those treatment centers, because I wanted them to know, for the families, that there was a place for them to find help and hope. So even though... I neglected to tell you, though, that when I married Lewis, I was really afraid because, you know, I already told you that I was married to my first husband twice without benefit of being divorced. And I married him once in Alabama, once in Mississippi. We were living in Arkansas when we got a divorce. And then I was getting ready to marry Lewis in Mississippi, and I was really worried that maybe I wasn't really divorced, that maybe I needed to go to one of those other states and get another divorce. I've never been quite sure about that. But I think being married 31 years covers that, if I'm not mistaken. So as time went on, I got sicker and sicker. And Lewis was looking pretty good, and I was looking really bad. I started running marathons, which there's nothing bad about that, but I forgot to eat. And I weighed less than 95 pounds. My hair was falling out. I couldn't look people in the eye, and I was literally an absolute nervous wreck. Now, raising these children, I had never raised my voice at any of them. I had never spanked any of them, and that is ludicrous, let me tell you. But I was into looking good. And I had four good children, I really did. All four of them are wonderful. And since Lewis's children came to live with us when they were 10 and 12, it's like, you know, they were part of me also. I just didn't have what some people call that yucky time when they were really, really little. But I got to experience teenage years, and that was lots of fun. You know, I was always available to my children because Lewis was never available because of alcoholism. He was always sitting in the chair or always drinking and passed out. And so we just tiptoed around him, and I made them think that everything was all right. I never said to him, "Daddy's sick or has an illness." I just said, "Let's just go do something different." And we would leave and leave him there. And I became a real part of their lives. One day Lewis told me that he was an alcoholic and he was going to quit drinking, and I said, "Okay, you know." I mean, at that point, who cared? I was just like absolutely numb. And he called AA that night in the middle of the night because, as I said, he drank because he couldn't sleep. So he called them, and they never called him back. He got the answering service, and they never called him back. And I got my first resentment against AA. Now, I didn't know that's what it was at the time, but it was, because I thought surely if they had called him back, our life would be better. When my dad went into treatment, the reason we had to put him in two times was the first time he came out and went to AA and took my brother with him. My brother absolutely adores AA meetings, and he loves Al-Anon meetings too. He loves to make the coffee, and he loves to be a part of the fellowship, and they made him feel welcome. And my dad kept going to meetings, and he kept drinking. But he kept getting his chips. Now, I don't mean 24-hour chips. I mean 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, 4 year, 5 year. But he was still drinking. And I was really, really mad at those people then. Now, I didn't know what y'all did at meetings. You know, I didn't know that. I'd never been to a meeting. Wasn't thinking about going to a meeting because you weren't keeping my dad sober. You were letting him drink, and you kept giving him these chip things, whatever that was. And he was no better. And things at his house were getting worse and worse and worse. Because by this time, my mother's mother was living with my dad and my brother and Rosalie. They were all living in the house together, and it was really like a zoo over there. Bebe was in her 90s, and she was picking my dad up off the floor at night when he'd fall out of the bed and changing the sheets in the middle of the night. You got the picture of what goes on in abject alcoholism. And I was terrified because he was still going to the office every day, that he was going to kill somebody. As a medical doctor, and I was really afraid, and so we did an intervention again and got him to go to treatment one more time. But it was really hard for me to finally go through the doors of Al-Anon for the first time, and what got me there was an incident with our teenage son. He came home one night having had too much to drink, just like teenagers will do, and I absolutely went ballistic. I found myself laying on top of him, hitting him upside the head. And I told you I'd never even spiked one of our kids or raised my voice. And I had on a ring that had a cross on it, and I made imprints of that cross in his face as I hit him. And I knew that something terrible was wrong with me. I knew that that was not the me that I wanted to be. Also, the next night or so, I ended up hitting my husband. There was physical violence in our home, but it came from me in those two instances because I had sunk so low that I didn't know what to do. And I was angry at God and angry at AA because whatever that place was, it hadn't done what it was supposed to be doing. I had a friend who kept inviting me to go to these Al-Anon meetings, and so finally I was hurting bad enough and had exhausted every other possible avenue that I decided I would go. Now, I wasn't worried that somebody there would know my husband was an alcoholic. I frankly didn't care. But I was very, very worried that someone there would know whose daughter I was. Now, that's ludicrous, isn't it? I had my dad in treatment. My mother was dead. But I was really, really afraid of that. Southern town doctor, you know, how can I let that out? So I went to my meeting, and I walked in the door, and first I saw this guy that went to high school with me, and that was hysterical. I mean, I couldn't believe it. But second of all, I turned and looked, and there was this beautiful lady sitting there with this gorgeous blonde hair, and she had been one of my parents' very dearest friends. Now, I know God put that lady in that meeting for me that night because it said to me, Helen, it's okay to be here. Her husband had been a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous for about 3 months, and she was very instrumental in the reason that I stayed in those meetings. And her husband died about 10 years ago now, and she still goes to meetings, and I just absolutely love that. I really do, because she believed that her life could change. I had hope that mine could change. And I sat there by her, and she patted my hand. And I sat in those rooms for months and months and cried every Tuesday and Friday night and couldn't even open my mouth. But you know what? You didn't ask me what my last name was. You didn't ask me who my parents were. You didn't ask me who the alcoholic was. You just asked me how I was doing. And you just patted me and told me that you loved me and just to sit down and to keep coming back and it would get better. I had never experienced such in my entire life. You didn't ask me to do anything for you. You didn't ask me to be anything. You just said, come and sit down. There's hope for you. And so I kept coming back. And after I'd been there a while, I decided, y'all kept talking about the steps and getting a sponsor and stuff like that. Well, I memorized the steps. I mean, I'm very bright, you know, the second time. I had also memorized the opening. I mean, I knew it by heart. Those things that you talk about that were slogans, oh, yuck. I mean, that was just awful, nauseating. That was way too simple. I mean, it had to be complex, you know. It had to be real thinking stuff. So I thought, let go and let God. What do you mean, you know? I mean, give me a break. Live and let live. That's what I got in my little thing when I came here on Friday, that little silver thing, live and let live. You know, I realized later on I knew nothing about living. I was not letting anybody else live their life, but I knew nothing about living mine because I didn't know what I wanted to be, who I wanted to be, or who I was. I knew nothing about myself. And I wasn't sure I wanted to know anything about myself, to be honest with you. I kind of just wanted everything to go away. I'd gotten so good at making up stories that I never knew where the stories ended and the truth began. I was really, really good at making up stories. You can imagine. I had practiced from a very young age, and I could tell some good ones, too. Now, I didn't know that that was lying exactly. You know, I thought that was just making people feel good, you know. One of my children says, Mother, has your glass ever been half empty? I think it is always half full, you know. I mean, that's the way I viewed life. But inside, I was dying. Today, I view life that way, and inside, I'm happy. It took a lot of years and a lot of work. Well, they talked about this sponsor thing, and so I looked around, and I was looking for somebody just like me. I wanted somebody who came from, you know, the right side of the tracks That's what I thought. Somebody who had both parents were alcoholics. Somebody who had children and stepchildren. I mean, I had a whole list, a laundry list, as it were. In fact, my husband is a good bit older than I am, and I've told him, you know, that if it just happens that he goes first, you know, that I'm not marrying again. But if I do, I do have a long list of things that I want. He just rolls his eyes and laughs at me. But I had my list for a sponsor, and I wasn't getting anywhere with it, and nor was I getting any better. And so the tears had not stopped, and the pain had not stopped. After I'd been there about 6 months, my husband went to his first AA meeting through no help from me, I can assure you, because by that time I was still holding on by a very, very light thread and not knowing whether I was going to be able to make it or not. But somebody took him to his first AA meeting, and he said he knew that he had come home. And he's been a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous for 15 years, and I am eternally grateful to AA for that. Has nothing to do with me. But I finally heard this woman in a meeting one night talking, and I knew that she had something I wanted. Now, I had read the little sponsorship pamphlet, and I had read and talked to people, but it just never clicked with me until that night, until I asked her to be my sponsor. And that woman literally walked me through all 12 steps and kept me at times when I needed to be kept, gave me what I call good orderly directions. I had a hard time keeping my mouth shut. Can you believe that? You know, I talked for some of my children because I certainly knew that they wouldn't know what to say. And so if they were slow of speech, then I would just keep on talking and tell whoever was talking to them what they meant to say. I never allowed my children to have a relationship with their dad because he was an alcoholic. He was drunk. And so I knew that they couldn't have a relationship with him, so I interfered. And for that, I have had to make amends to all of them. But I was really one of those people that was so busy sending, it was hard for me to receive. Now, sometimes the sending was not verbally out loud. It was in my brain. You know, I was making up another story or figuring out how this was going to end up, or if he said this and she says that and they do this and they do that, then this is how it's going to turn out. And you might have been talking to me, but I totally was paying no attention because I was so busy thinking of the next thing that was going to happen. So one of the things my sponsor first told me early on was that when I had that urge, that compulsion to interrupt and to talk for one of my children or to talk when my husband was trying to have a conversation with them, I needed to put my tongue between my teeth and to bite down. Well, I tried that for a while, but sometimes it just kind of slipped out. And so she said, well, if that's not working, then I suggest you go to your closet. And I spent a lot of time in my closet my first 2 years in the program. I got real familiar going through the clothes, you know, just like this. And I would stand in there, literally, I did that. I had strong sponsorship, and that's the way I sponsor people today. It's not mean, it's not ugly, it's loving, and it's kind, and it's strong. It's not controlling. The person has the right to say yes or no and do whatever they want to do. But I don't carry the people that I sponsor, nor was I carried. I was told things that were suggestions that might help me, and if I wanted to follow them, I could. And if I didn't, that was fine. I was never told to leave him or to leave children somewhere or to do anything like that, but I was told that no matter what, my sponsor would be with me, whatever decisions I made. After I'd been in the program about 7 years, I hate to admit this, I had one of those years where I almost came unglued. That was the first time that I really recognized and admitted that I was angry. All of those years of stuffing all that anger had to come out some way, and I was afraid to admit it because I was afraid if I once got it out that I'd never get it back in and I'd just be an angry, angry woman, and I didn't want to be that because I'm nice. And in one of the workshops, somebody did the little quote, you know, say what you mean and mean what you say, but don't say it mean. And I thought if I said what I meant, that it would be mean. And so I couldn't ever say what I meant. But I finally learned how to say what I meant. And I'll tell you, I felt real mean for a long time. And I probably was from time to time. There was a point during the one of the days of that 7 years that if I'd had a gun, I'd have killed my husband. Now, this is 7 years into the program and having worked the steps and doing service. But I was remembering things that I could not put down. And so my sponsor knew I was that bad off, and she took me to her house and kept me there overnight because she knew better than to let me go home. And we prayed and talked, and I was able to work through some of those things. It was, our marriage was a long time healing. You don't live in alcoholism for almost 25 years and it heal overnight. It just doesn't happen that way. I hate to tell you. Or maybe I really want to tell you that, because if you're struggling tonight, I want to tell you there is hope. Today my husband and I have an incredibly, incredibly wonderful relationship. I would not trade it for the world. I wouldn't. It's not perfect, but it is so wonderful, wonderful, blessed. I absolutely adore him. We are different as night and day, and I celebrate that today. I no longer am trying to make him like me, and he's no longer trying to make me like him, which was what we did to each other before we came here. And so we ended up with two non-entities. My husband wears blue jeans all the time. He has a beard, and I started to say he smokes a pipe, but y'all, he quit smoking 3 weeks ago. But what a miracle, that is a miracle, and I might share a little bit about that. But we today enjoy each other's company, and we enjoy being apart, too, and having our own interests that are different from each other. And that is a blessing of this program. 8 years ago, my husband decided that it would be fun if we would kind of look around and maybe move somewhere, and I thought it would be exciting also. We'd worked through a lot of that pain, and we decided that maybe it was time for us to find a place of our own. And so we were going to look around. And we've been investing in the Hill Country of Texas for about 25 years, and we thought that would be a wonderful place to retire. And through a very whirlwind set of circumstances, we sold our house, we sold lots of different things, and we decided to move. And now, I was raised in Jackson, Mississippi all my life, had lifelong friends there, my program was there, my sponsor was there, but it was going to be great, an adventure to move. One more time, I was in denial. It was really an adventure, but it was really, really hard. For those of y'all who have moved, it is hard to change your home group. It's hard to leave your sponsor. It's hard to leave the women that I sponsored, because we had a really strong family. Somebody was saying today about the president of AA, I think. He thought that that guy was the president of AA. Well, my husband sponsored a bunch of young kids in Mississippi when we were there. He went to the club, and a lot of kids went there from halfway houses, and they just adored him. And he had one of these kids who was from California, and we were always having something at our house, some Al-Anon something. I was always doing something, involved in service, doing something, having potlucks at our house or whatever. And we had a really involved and strong group. And so one day Josh told somebody that his sponsor's wife was president of Al-Anon. And I was so embarrassed, and of course I had to sit him down and explain to him, we don't have any presidents, we have no people like that, you know, yadda-dee, yadda-dee. Well, would you believe that after we moved to Texas, I got elected trustee, and I just finished serving 3 years as chairperson of the board of trustees, and that person is called, in our bylaws, the president of Al-Anon. But you know, I called up Josh to tell him, because it was like me making amends to him, because I'm sure I embarrassed him back then. But you know, the most important thing that I am, was, and always will be is an Al-Anon member. My home group is the New Beginnings Al-Anon Family Group in Kerrville, Texas. And if you're ever there on a Wednesday night at 8 o'clock, we're in the church next to the Walmart, behind the church, over the the barn back there, and you can come to a wonderful meeting. But when we moved to Kerrville, it wasn't like that. I started going to meetings, and nobody spoke to me. Nobody put out their hand and said, welcome, and I was furious. I would not have treated anybody like that. I went home, I called my sponsor long distance, and I said, you will not believe what happened to me at this meeting. And I thought I was going to get this, oh, poor baby. But I already told you what kind of sponsorship I have. That was not what I got back. I got silence, and I was quiet, and she said, what was wrong with you? Was your hand broken? And you know, she was absolutely right. Every time I'm in a room now, whether I'm the only person in there who doesn't know anybody, or I'm at a table, or I walk up to people, I'm always quick to say, hi, my name is Helen. and can I have a hug or can I give you a hug? Because it's real important to me that that hand is extended and that I live by the slogan, let it begin with me. You know, if there's going to be any change in this world, it's got to begin with me. If I don't begin it, where is it going to begin? And I didn't like that for a long time. Early on, my sponsor told me that if I wasn't the problem, there was no hope. And I didn't like that for a long time. She also had me read May the 30th in One Day at a Time every morning and every night for 6 months. And I don't know if you know what that says or not, but it says, Al-Anon is boiled down to a well-worn phrase, mind your own business. So I had a large dose of minding my own business, shutting my mouth and working the steps and keeping on going. Well, I kept going to these meetings, and I knew if I didn't go that that I would be worse. But I would leave crying and feeling worse than when I went. And so I decided to start a meeting, and I did. And things are much better there now, because not just because of the meeting I started, but more and more people have moved in. It was a small town, and they were used to doing it their way. And I wasn't used to a small town. And that was very, very hard for me. And program meetings are a little different. That's why you go to yours and I go to mine. And that's what makes us all click, and that's why it works the way it works. The longer I was there, the more I saw the things that I needed to change about myself, and which was a bonus for me. It was very hard leaving all my friends and my sponsor. And I found another sponsor finally, and then I started having relationships with people there, and that was good. My husband had some serious illness after we moved there. We decided this past week that we're on a 2-year cycle. After we'd been there, we were there the first year, he tore his shoulder and he had 5 shoulder surgeries the next year. And then 2 years after that, he had a hip replacement. And everything that could go wrong did go wrong. And I would like to tell you that I acted like a woman full of grace and dignity, but I did not. This was many years into the program at this time, and I acted terrible. I yelled and screamed and cried at God, and some days I even yelled and screamed at the nurses and doctors. I became as obsessed with Lewis's health as I had been with alcoholism when I was a young girl. And I saw myself in that mirror, you know. I had held that mirror up and I saw, here's the problem looking back at you. What are you going to do different? So I had to start over at step one, of course. And I had the ability to do that because you taught me how to do that. But it took some while for that to heal. I can still drive by that little hospital and get real anxious inside, because we live with some of the after effects of that botched surgery. Because my husband and I love to dance, and he can't stand on his right leg anymore by itself. But we still dance. We took 2-step lessons. We learned to 2-step. You know, we live in country, Texas country, and we can do that, and we love to jitterbug, and we can do that. So there are lots of positive things. We just can't slow dance. But you don't need to see a slow dance anyway. So, you know, we can do that in the privacy of our home. Then 2 years after that, he got cancer. And I will tell you that that was the most wonderful experience of our life. And I can tell you that with honesty. We had a fabulous time, and it was all about my attitude. And isn't that amazing? You know, you taught me about the 3 A's, and I've been excited to see all of that on the Alateen table, awareness, acceptance, and action. I was fine with awareness, but I was not fine with acceptance. I wanted to move from awareness to action. I didn't want any of that acceptance bit, you know. I didn't like that. In the One Day at a Time, it talks about surrender and submission. And, you know, in submission we say, you know, one day, there'll come a day that it's going to change. And that was how I did acceptance, you know. I was, like, on the edge. Let me just be aware that we've got this problem here. Let me take some action. But don't make me sit with the pain too long. And that's what that illness did for me. It taught me how to sit with the pain and how to get over it and to take the actions necessary. About 6 weeks ago now, I guess, my husband had a small stroke. But, you know, we're doing okay with that, too. We had some angels that took care of us. It's amazing what will happen when you call and say the right things. I don't get upset and irritable like I used to. I'm at peace amidst a lot of pain some days. And we're having a wonderful, wonderful time. He didn't come with me this weekend because we're in the Civil Air Patrol, and he was going on the Civil Air Patrol thing. And when I called him yesterday, I thought he'd be out in West Texas flying in the mountains, but he's at home. And he had taken the dogs to the vet, and he said, "I'm not going to get them. I'm having a weekend alone, and I'm glad you're gone." And so I'm the doer in our family, the type A personality, and he's the laid back one, and he is wonderful. And he keeps me steady, and he keeps me calm, and he laughs at me, and I laugh at him today. I didn't think he was very funny all of those years, but today I think he's a stitch. And he probably hasn't changed that much. We had alcoholism, you know, tears families apart, and one of our children distanced herself from the rest of us and would not allow me to see our grandchildren for about 3 years. I know it was longer than that, 5 years. And that was very painful for me because I absolutely adore little children. I'm not particularly fond of old people. I don't know what I'm doing in a program full of old people sometimes. And, you know, I'm into looking good, and so I want y'all to keep on looking good like you are. And but I'm getting older, too. Isn't that weird? And but during those years that I couldn't see the grandchildren, you know, I wanted to go beat down her door, and I wanted to say, you crazy person, what are you doing? And you taught me that I just had to learn to love her just like she was. And when I would want to pick up the phone and call her and say something, I would grip the arms of the chair and pray the serenity prayer. And it was during one of those moments that I realized what I was praying for. It was very simple. I was praying for courage. I was praying for serenity. I was praying for peace. And those are some of the blessings of this program. The back-to-basics thing that I need so badly on a daily basis, that I'm given on a daily basis if I will ask for them. And so I waited and waited, and during the time that her dad was so sick, she did call and did allow us to see the children, and now she is back in our life. You know, I don't have to go up to her and ask her about all that time and what went on and everything, because she told me just to love her and to accept her. That word I don't like. Acceptance, acceptance, acceptance. And it keeps rearing its head. I'm so grateful that you have taught me so many lessons and given me so much joy and excitement. I would be remiss if I didn't close with this one little story because several people have asked me to tell it. You know, one of the things that I learned in service was that I had many opportunities to learn how to practice the principles of this program. I had many opportunities to heal things and to take them home with me. It was hard for me to practice communication at home, but I could practice communication with you, and in an area assembly, I definitely got to practice communication. And at a board meeting, I get to practice communication. And I get to practice saying what I mean and not saying it mean. And then I can go home and do those things a little bit and a little bit more. But I still am a person that likes to look good. I just don't know when I'm going to be healed of that. I'm not sure I ever will. But that's okay, too. So I was at this RSS in Iowa where she met me, and I went into my room. It was a hotel, an older hotel that had been remodeled. And I did what women do. I don't know what men do, but you make your little nest. That's what we do. I opened the drawers, you know, I put my clothes out and everything. I hung my stuff up, and I went in the bathroom, you know, put my little dot kit out and everything. And then, you know, I went to the bathroom, and then I got up, and I was going downstairs to meet with all the people and everything, and I turned around to flush the toilet, and I couldn't find the flusher. And I thought, well, okay. I'm smart. I'm the chairperson of the board. I can find the flusher. So I looked, and I pushed on the seat. You know, I thought maybe it was, like, sensitive, you know. Nothing happened. So I sat back down again, and I leaned back, you know. And then I got up, and I turned around. Nothing happened. So then I got down on my all fours. You know, they have those little things that you screw down, you know, that keep the toilet on the floor. And I started pushing on those, and then I said, "Oh, my God, Helen, look at yourself. You are on the floor trying to find the flusher. You are the chairperson of the Board of Trustees, and you cannot find the flusher." Oh, I mean, I'm just horrified. I'm turning red telling y'all this story. I really am. How am I going to go down and tell these people that I can't find the flusher? I mean, I can't do it. So I'm on the floor anyway, and so I said, "Okay, God, I'm on my knees. Now, let me tell you, what is it? Am I learning? I'm learning humility here. Humility. I'm humble before your throne." So I said, well, I'm just going to have to go down and tell them. So I got up off the floor, and I went to wash my hands, because it had been in places you don't want your hands. And when I turned on the cold water, would you believe right next to the cold water spigot was the flusher for the toilet? Now, don't ask me why they had it there. I never asked. But, you know, in service, that's what I've learned. Humility. I've learned wonderful, wonderful lessons from people like you. And I wouldn't trade them for anything. Because today, I do believe that I am a whole, healed person who is trudging this road of happy destiny. I want to close with a reading from the One Day at a Time. A little bitty bit. Adjusting myself to things as they are and being able to love without trying to interfere with or control anyone else, however close to me, that is what I search for and find in Al-Anon. The learning is sometimes painful. The reward is life itself, rich, full, and serene. And today I have all of those things, thanks to people like you. Thank you for having me.
So, well, I tell you, Helen, we have a special gift for you. This gift is for you on behalf of the convention committee. We wanted to give this so you'll always remember us people in Massachusetts to talk funny. I have to apologize. I didn't do the opening. Sorry. But I will read our tradition of anonymity. There may be some who are not familiar with our tradition of personal anonymity at the public level. If so, we respectfully ask that no Al-Anon, AA, or Al-Anon speaker be identified by full name or picture in published or broadcast reports of our meeting. The insurance of anonymity is essential to our efforts to help other families of alcoholics, and our tradition of anonymity reminds us that Al-Anon and Al-Anon principles come before personalities. In closing, I would like to say that the opinions expressed here were strictly those of the person who gave them. Take what you like and leave the rest. The things you heard were spoken in confidence and should be treated as confidential. Keep them within the walls of this room and the confines of your mind. A few special words to those of you who have not been with us long. Whatever your problems, there are those among us who have had them too. Try to keep an open mind. You will find help. You will come to realize that there is no situation too difficult to be bettered and no unhappiness too great to be lessened. We aren't perfect. The welcome we give you may not show the warmth we have in our hearts for you. After a while, you'll discover that though you may not like all of us, you love us in a very special way, the same way we already love you. Talk to each other. We can think out with someone else, but let there be no gossip of criticism with one another. Instead, let the understanding, love, and peace of the program grow in you one day at a time. Will all who care to join me in the closing prayer? And as you're standing up, I have a tradition in my group. I always hug. I love hugs. So could you turn to your left and hug, and then turn to your right and hug?